This tape is a production of Bald Roads Ministry. Your speaker is Vin Lewis, founder and president of Bald Roads Ministry. This particular tape attempts to examine the relationship between religion and feelings. In these tape series, which we call Christian Basics, ARM takes a slightly different approach than it does in the rest of its tapes. Most of the times, ARM is presenting a truth from an inflexible point of view, or exposing an error from a completely inflexible point of view. In the other tapes, the logic is rigid, elegant, precise, and inflexible. In these tapes, the Christian Basics, we try to take, in so much as we can, a non-denominational approach to the subject matter. We try to deal with basic issues which are applicable to all religious discussions, but we take them from a Christian context. By this I mean the most broadest sense of that word. We do this so that we might approach those Christians of all denominations in trying to bring them to a certain unified position from which they can proceed on their own search for truth, which ultimately should bring them closer to God, the true religion, and, so we hope personally, salvation. With this in mind, one should understand that this tape is not designed to be an exact thesis, a precise definitional defense of an extremely petty and, shall we say, academic pedantic position. Instead, it is a much more free-flowing, much more human, much more informal approach to basic issues. What we're trying to do is to make it as broad as possible without it losing significance, meaning, and result. Now, let me deal with the issue of feelings. Feelings, by definition, are part of every normal person. Every normal person feels. Every normal person has the sensations which are feelings. They are part of and connected to human nature. Now, so that the confusion which may arise shall be reduced to a minimum, at least I will attempt to reduce it to a minimum, allow me to define a few key terms. Feelings are sensations which a person is aware of and which begin a reaction in him, inducing a behavior change or a conscious decision. A variation on this definition would be, feelings are sensations and inclinations which arise without obvious cause or choice on the part of the person experiencing them. In other words, you do not intend to feel something. You do not make a decision to feel something. Again, this may seem a little complex, but I think it is absolutely necessary for us to understand the distinction between feelings and other sensations before we can proceed and examine the issue of feelings. Related to feelings are emotions. Emotions are sensations which are developed, and by that I mean of a longer duration than a feeling, and of a more cohesiveness, a more focused nature. And emotions reflect a value system consciously accepted by the person experiencing the emotion. If one wants to, one could consider that emotions are the offspring of a marriage between a feeling and a conscious act of free will to accept the feeling. Passions are sensations which, having earlier been emotions, are now intensified to the degree that the passion becomes the primary motivation in a person's behavior, that is, the person experiencing the passion. If one wished to rank a hierarchy of these sensations, one might very well say that feelings are the start, emotions the development, and passions the fulfillment of a single sensation that a person experiences. Now, let me explain what I do not include in feelings. I do not include those sensations or reactions which are primarily or purely physical. This also means reflexes. As an example, I am ignoring such things as pain, illness, surprise, extreme hot, extreme cold, etc. Or shock. These type of reactions are things which are centered in the body, not in the soul, so to speak. They can and do give rise to feelings, they are frequently cause of feelings, but they are not what I mean by feelings. The reflexes and the sensations and the reactions which I just mentioned can usually be measured by scientific instruments. You can measure the degree of sugaring, you can measure the degree of pain to a certain degree, you can measure, as polygraphs do, the degree of stress that a person goes through based on an individual reaction to a situation. However, feelings are primarily subjective. There may be physical evidence for feelings and for emotions and for passions, but feelings remain something which are beyond the actual precise measurement by any scientific means. Dealing with the issue of subjective and objective, I suggest you obtain our tape, The Elements of Logic, in which some of this is explained at greater length. If you're confused with those terms, objective means primarily that which can be measured by an outside source, subjective, that which must be accepted on faith alone, as it is not, cannot be measured. The first point I would like to make about these feelings, to sort of establish the nature of feelings, is that feelings simply seem to be. In other words, they don't seem to have a history, they're simply there. We do not choose to bring them about, we do not induce them. If we were to induce a feeling, what we're talking about is an emotion. Feelings simply are there. The person experiencing the feeling simply recognizes that, and this recognition or realization brings about an inducement to do something. And this inducement to do something, to react in a certain way, is human action. So in other words, feelings bring about human action. Not all human action is a result of feelings, but all feelings bring about human action. By human action, I mean any activity brought about by a human being with a goal in mind and with an acknowledgement of a certain incentive. Usually the incentive is a sense of uncomfortableness, and the action is designed to reduce the uncomfortableness. Again, when I am talking about this, I am talking about it in a conscious sense. So therefore, a feeling to get up and turn the TV to another channel, to have a drink of water, to scratch one's head, or to volunteer to join an army, all of these things are feelings which induce human actions because a conscious decision is made. If you suppress a feeling, in other words, you do not scratch your head, you do not change the channel when you wish to, you have made a conscious decision to suppress the feeling. This is also human action. Again, I hold that every feeling leads to human action. As an example of what I'm not talking about, when I am not, to not be included in feelings, is when you are asleep and roll over at night because you're in an uncomfortable position. This is not a conscious decision made by you because you are not conscious. You are asleep. This is a physical reaction or a reflex, and it's quite different. Our first relationship between feeling and religion is in the area of temptations. Temptations are feelings in which a sensation arises which induces the person to hold that an evil thing, act, thought, etc. is desirable. I point out that a temptation may be the responsibility of the person involved, or may not. At this point, I would like to introduce the concept of the occasion of sin. If one knows, based on past experience, or simply through any other form of gaining knowledge, that one is likely to be tempted by a certain person, place, thing, or situation, if one intentionally and avoidably puts oneself in that position, then one is putting oneself in the occasion of sin where the temptation is likely to arise. I mentioned the word avoidably. As an example, if one has a natural inclination to be a shoplifter, one should not go into a store where the security is light. However, if one is a fireman and is forced into the store to put out a fire and is alone in the store, the temptation may be there, but there's no way in that case to avoid it, unless we get into the philosophical decision of should the person have ever become a fireman to begin with. That's not the point I'm dealing with here. If you consciously, intentionally, and in a way you could avoid, put oneself in a situation where evil feelings, that is to say temptations, arise, then one is putting oneself in the occasion of sin. If one puts oneself in this situation unavoidably, unforeseeably, then the occasion of sin is not the fault of the person. I point out here, of course, that a temptation is not a sin. A temptation is only an inducement to sin. Sin occurs only when the temptation is acceded to, accepted, welcomed, and developed into an emotion. Again, feelings bring about things, but feelings themselves are morally neutral. Let us notice what occurs here with a feeling. If the feeling is good, in other words, the feeling, the inclination to be charitable, forgiving, patient, etc., one does that, one reacts on it, one develops it, one develops an emotion, the emotion becomes a virtue, because it is a conscious, developed decision to do something in accord with God's will. If, on the other hand, one takes the bad inclination towards sloth, gluttony, drunkenness, lust, anger, pride, if one takes that inclination and develops it, then one is developing a vice. By the same token, if one resists the vice towards sloth, lust, pride, etc., then one is building up endurance, which itself is a virtue, the virtue of fortitude, the virtue of resisting temptation. As St. Paul says in his epistles, the concept of endurance leads to fortitude, courage, and this leads to virtue, and this type of virtue leads to salvation. Again, feelings have a quite intimate relationship with Christian morality here, in the sense that feelings are temptations, or feelings are inclinations towards virtue, but even the resisting of a temptation can be, and definitely is, a situation which produces virtue. Now, we must be careful when we deal with the concept of temptations. The Bible tells us that essentially the sources of evil are the world, the flesh, and the devil. The world being that social contact that we have with other people. Sometimes this is referred to in a simple form, or at least one variation of it, as peer pressure, what everybody else does. It's the social and cultural environment in which we find ourselves. The art, the entertainment, the customs, the mores, the government, the laws, etc., the family situations. The flesh is, quite literally, our human nature, its natural inclinations to do things which are bad. Now, when I say natural, what I mean is fallen natural. Since Adam's sin, man's nature has been crippled, not destroyed, but it has been changed. And the problem with this is that we now have more of a temptation or inclination towards bad things than Adam did. The technical term for this is concupiscence. I mention it simply in case you ever hear it. Concupiscence is that tendency inherited by men as a result of Adam's sin, which inclines us to choose evil over good, inclines us to do the wrong thing as opposed to the right thing. When St. Paul refers to the devil, what he simply means is Satan, that force, that personalized force, that fallen angel of evil at war with God, who roams the world seeking the ruin of souls. Again, temptations in themselves are not evil, only if they are accepted. Another point about the sense of feelings here is that very frequently, as a matter of fact, I cannot think of an example of which would disprove it, but let's assume it's a general situation rather than a principle. Very frequently, the natural temptations that arise are unnatural versions of natural feelings. Example, it is quite natural for us to desire a person of the opposite gender. It is quite natural for us to wish to have a certain amount of time and recreation. It is quite natural for us to desire affirmation by our friends and loved ones that we have done well. Now, in the first example, the unnatural form of this is lust. The natural inclination is love. So therefore, the feeling which can induce love can also induce lust. In the second case, the natural inclination towards recreation and relaxation naturally can lead to a sense of serenity and submission of God's will. unnaturally can lead to the sin of sloth or laziness. In the third case, the natural affirmation, the desire for affirmation that we do things good can lead to a sense of accomplishment, to energy, to dedication. The unnatural form of it can lead to a sense of pride. Point here is that the feelings in us are natural. I've said this before. They are inherently part of human nature. Feelings are not bad. Temptations are not bad in the sense of temptations are not sin. But almost every temptation has a corresponding good temptation or inclination towards virtue. It is wrong for us to war against our feelings, because to war against our feelings is to war against our very nature, put us in a case of constant warfare, constant stress. Better instead to take the inclinations of feelings, to understand the real source of them, and to find a natural, proper, and good outlet for them. To dwell with this matter a little further, to put it slightly differently, feelings are put into us by God for a purpose. If they were not the natural desire for a person of the opposite gender, it is doubtful whether the world would reproduce. If they were not the natural desire to do jobs well, it would be doubtful if there would be art, engineering, architecture, or other accomplishments. If it were not for the natural inclination for us to rest, to relax, to enjoy, there would probably be nothing but drudgery and a terrible slavery of the soul and of the body on earth. These inclinations, these tendencies, are part of human nature. In order for a person to be, quote, well-rounded, unquote, that is to say, spiritually healthy, he cannot deny his feelings. He cannot be at war with his feelings. Instead, what he must do is acknowledge the feelings and turn them into proper emotions, and of course, if he is so inclined, by his nature, to turn them into passions. So we have, of course, the situation we all know of, at least in literature and if not in reality, of the starving artist who is not willing to compromise his art, who is willing to live in the cold, freezing attic, literally starving to death for the sake of writing the great symphony or painting the great picture. The artist who will not sell his painting because he does not believe that the buyer will appreciate it correctly. These situations are when a passion has taken over. A passion is a good thing if it is done for a good purpose. If we look at some of the great men in Christianity, such as St. Francis of Assisi, we see a passion there which brought a great deal of joy and happiness. Again, to involve the entire human being into a primary motivating sensation is to become a passionate person. Some of us seem to be inclined by that, by our natures, by our personalities, from conception. Some of us do not. But again, if we are of the passionate nature, our job is to recognize the feelings, to develop them into the emotions, and then to take them to the proper place where they provide the motivation which will bring us closer to God. Have a passion for truth or a passion for justice. But if you don't, an emotion for truth or an emotion for justice will also serve. Now, when we are dealing with the concept of religion and feelings, it is important for us to be able to determine in advance what feelings are good, what feelings are not. Again, feelings arise and they cause in us a conscious act, primarily acceptance or rejection. If we accept it, it becomes an emotion. If it becomes an emotion, and if the emotion is sustained over a long period of time, it becomes part of our value system. And ultimately, our value system determines the type of person we are. By the same token, if those feelings are evil, if we take them the wrong way, if we develop them and they become an habitual emotion, we are developing ourselves into the type of person which we should not be. So again, the key thing to do is to be able to recognize a feeling as correct or incorrect, proper, improper, and develop it properly. The recognition, the evaluation, the judgment of a feeling is the key question in religion. How does one determine whether this feeling is good or this feeling is bad? How does one know, so to speak, that the voice that one hears is from God or from the devil? Well, One way is to go through the concept of universality. I have proven in another tape, it is called P, as in philosophy, 1, available from Arm, that universal feelings, universal expressions, universal opinions must be true. So therefore, let us look at the universal feelings, which are reflected throughout all of nature. One, for an example, which is so common and so well known as to be a cliche, is the concept of maternal love. The expression of this person has a face that only a mother could love, or the concept of mother's love, means this unqualified natural inclination that a woman has to her offspring to desire for the benefit of that offspring and to protect that offspring, to nurture that offspring. This is the maternal instinct. This does not mean to say that every woman has it to the same degree as every other woman, and it does not mean to say that sin is impossible where a woman may reject this maternal instinct, this inclination. But the point is, we find in every culture, in every history, in all of poetry, in all of literature, in all of art, the maternal instinct being expressed. We find it quite natural. We find it universal. And if it is natural, and if it is universal, what it is from God and good. This, therefore, would lead us to the obvious conclusion that anything that goes against the maternal instinct, anything which wars against it, anything which considers it secondary, petty, wrong, a burden, is wrong. So our natural inclination here is to advance maternal feelings and maternity, or, as we say, motherhood. In this case, this would be one argument on why abortion certainly is wrong, and one argument on why feminism is wrong. Notice what we are advancing here is not the logical, biblical, scriptural, doctrinal positions. We are trying to explain how feelings, universal feelings, can incline us towards the proper position. No matter how smart you are, or how non-smart you are, logic is a tool which needs a certain degree of acumen, development, and inclination, study, experience to use correctly. Therefore, one may very well be misled by logic. One can be misled by sophistry, that is, essentially word games which appear to be wisdom. To be misled by these is understandable, because some people can impress, some people can speak quickly, some people can intimidate verbally. But the feelings, if one is, quote, in touch with one's feelings, which come from God, which are universal, which are developed properly into an emotion, cannot be fooled. The feelings which come from God, which are part of us, which we have developed when we were young, or when they first arose, are the ultimate source of our morality, if everything else fails. They are the citadel which should not be able to be taken. Now, can we be misled by our feelings? Certainly we can. But the only real way to be misled by one's feelings is to not follow the feelings, but to follow something else instead. Why do I say this? Because feelings arise primarily, and again, I'm not talking about the sensations of heat and cold and pain and joy and surprise, when we are alone, when we are quiet, when we are thinking, when we have the time to recognize, deal with, and develop our feelings. This is, I believe, the reason for the advocacy of Christian meditation and silent prayer. It is at times like this when we are not distracted by the world, when we can retreat from the world, both in both senses of that word, either internally retreat in our own sense or go on the religious activity, which is called a retreat. It is at times like that that we can understand our feelings, evaluate them, look at their consequences without, shall we say, badgering from other people, without opposition from other people, without the temptations of the world. It is at times like this that we can understand which feelings are correct, which are not. It is at times like this we can develop those feelings, build on them, and make them into strong emotions. Now, one of the problems here, of course, is that if we do not spend this time by ourselves with God, we can have feelings which are perverted, misled by the world, that is by our social groups, by our denominations, into essentially a brainwashing situation, or if one wants to put it this way, a heartwashing situation. It is my own personal unfortunate experience that I have found a large majority of people have very strong conflicting emotions in them, conflicting feelings, because the natural feelings which are inside of them, which are a result of the natural law written on their heart by God, are in severe conflict with their denominational belief systems. These belief systems are not advanced in a logical fashion, but are advanced in a feeling fashion. The leader tells the believer that he must feel this, he must experience this. When the person inside does not, when he understands this conflict with his feeling, he's in a state of dis-ease, he is in a state of tremendous spiritual stress. And what usually is done in this case is the concept of private prayer and real meditation, an honest retreat, a real evaluation, is always prevented. It is prevented by essentially a feminist-type brainwashing, a Nazi-type brainwashing, and these are the things that we must avoid. If one is not sure what one feels, if one is not sure what emotions one has developed, if one is not sure what virtues are, and what the real inclination towards truth is, and what truth really is, then one should drop back, relax, and without inducement, experience, evaluate by oneself, build that citadel, build that final buttress for truth, for recognition of truth, for the seeking of truth, for the seeking of virtue. I think this is the ultimate place of feelings in religion. To have a foundation which is built separately from logic, separately from scripture, separately from the opinions of men, separately from the elegant systems that even Arm will build other times. And this will be in accord with the natural law written on our heart. This does not mean to say that one ignores various different things, such as history, such as literature, such as culture, but one has a natural inclination towards the finer things, and again, the universal consent of mankind as to what the higher values are, what the finer things are reflections of this universal feeling which all normal people have as part of them. Additional copies of this tape, or any of the related tapes, and among the related tapes other than the ones I mentioned, I would suggest tape M7 and tape H9, which also deals with the issue of feelings and religion. You may contact us at ARM55 Palen, that's P as in Paul, A-L-E-N, Road, Hopewell Junction, New York, 12533. This has been Lewis, encouraging you to contact me if you have any questions, suggestions, or criticisms. Thank you for listening. I hope it's been a benefit to you. God bless. This tape is a production of All Roads Ministry. Your speaker is Ben Lewis, president and founder of All Roads Ministry. All Roads Ministry produces a number of products, all of which are designed ultimately to help people come to understand the basic truths of Christianity, to accept them, to affirm them, explain them, teach them, etc. This particular series of tapes, which we call Christian Basics, takes a slightly softer approach, so to speak. It is designed not to be confrontational, not to be, shall we say, overwhelming, but rather persuasive and influential. Because of that, our approach in this series tends to be a little more informal, a little more relaxed. What we try to do in these series of tapes is to examine basic Christian principles, basic Christian issues, etc., from universalist positions, that is, positions in which all Christians, whether they are really Christians or simply claim to be that, can accept, understand, and tend to come together. In other words, these tapes are an attempt, sort of, at unifying Christian beliefs. This does not mean to say that Christians can be on opposite sides of each and every issue. That is not a tenable position. What I'm simply saying here is we tend to start from a non-denominational point of view and try to arrive at a conclusion. This particular tape deals with the issue of art in religion. Now, although one would think that art should not be a controversial subject, it is, it has been, and probably always will be. But almost all of this controversy which arises on the concept of art is in the area of good art versus bad art. What is art versus craft? Or how should art be paid for, funded, supported, or should it be at all? In other words, should it pay its own way? And as long as I've mentioned the word craft, allow me to bring it up and sort of define it first, as is our policy at ARM. We try to define words which we think will have a significant role in our discussion. Craft is any activity of human behavior which is physical, which leads to an end result, and which is designed primarily for use and function and made to a set formula, school, or pattern. Certainly within craft, individuality is allowed, but it is highly restricted. Now, again, there are some areas of art which enter into controversy in the Christian area, in the religion area. And allow me to point out, as I briefly alluded to before, that Christians cannot be on both sides of certain issues. After all, Christians hold that truth is important. Christians hold that God intervened in the history of man to teach man, reveal to man, certain basic truths. And we Christians hold that Jesus came to earth to bear witness to truth, and that we shall know truth, and that if we ask for things in faith, we shall come to a knowledge of this truth. Therefore, Christians, real Christians, cannot disagree on basic issues. One side of real Christianity, one sign to realize that people are true Christians, is that they are united, as St. Paul said, in one faith, under one Lord, by one baptism. However, as I've also stated, the tone of this tape, or this series of tapes, is not controversial, but educational in what we hope is a persuasive manner. And again, therefore, for the purposes of this tape, I shall refer to those who claim to be Christian, even if their claim is false, and include them on the generic term of Christian. Back to the main issue, if I may. Some Christian groups, primarily the Catholic and Orthodox groups, and those which tend to be closer to those denominations, have a heavy emphasis on some of the aspects of art in Christian behavior, in their decoration of their churches, and in their religious lives and practices. Other Christian groups, primarily those Protestant denominations which tend to have a heavy Calvinistic tendency, are either very sparing in their use of art or completely opposed to it, at least in theory, if not in practice. Therefore, it is controversial, so to speak, in the sense that there are two quote-unquote Christian sides on this issue. Again, only one of them can be correct, and this is one of the ways that one can determine whether he is truly in the Christian camp, so to speak, on this issue. I believe that I've proceeded long enough without defining the word art. And before I do, however, let me draw a distinction between the classic dichotomy, division of art. There is performing art and plastic or creative art. The performing arts are those which take place in real time, where bodily movement or expression is the primary means of communication, while the non-human aspects, such as the props in a theater, theatrical production, are given little or no importance. The performing arts are primarily dance, theater, song, orally presented poetry, movies, etc. They are not our primary concern here, although sometimes the statements I make will be appropriate, as some Christians feel that dance is an inappropriate artistic expression for Christians. The creative arts are primarily painting, sculpture, and architecture, what might very well be considered as a hybrid art, actually being more of a craft, but generally people will consider architecture part of art, especially when it's intended to be. These arts are the areas of the great disagreements among Christians. Now art, this type of art, is defined as the end result of a creative act by a man, which is inspired by something universal and noble in man, and which is intended to convey to others and bring about an emotional reaction, leading in the observer to something good. Now again, this is a somewhat complex definition, but I don't think anything else will suffice. Art is an act of communication. It is an end result of communication. The artist says to the beholder, look at this and react. React in the way in which I am suggesting. That reaction might be very little more than simple enjoyment or appreciation of what the artist has done. That is, I hold, both noble and allowable, acceptable, and good in man. It is good to appreciate things. It is good to admire artists. There is nothing wrong with simple enjoyment. In other words, there's nothing wrong with pleasure for its own sake, unless the pleasure is specifically forbidden. And again, this is a long definition, but I believe there's no other way to do it. Therefore, it is obvious that not every piece of sculpture, nor every painting, every mosaic, and every mural could possibly be considered as art. I will not here set up rules, or shall we say, detailed criteria by which one can determine the difference between good and bad art. Good art simply accomplishes its goal, and bad art does not. Now, of course, there's a spectrum in between good, better, best masterpieces, and so-so, poor, not-so-good, and completely rotten. But essentially, art is produced for an intention. If it accomplishes its intention, it's art. If it doesn't, it's a failure, and it's something else, or bad art. And art is, to a very high degree, universal, if that phrase means anything whatsoever. Now, certainly, styles and tastes changed, but a great art of one age is the taste of another age. In other words, what was considered great in the Renaissance, great in ancient times, great in modern times, great in the Victorian times, great at the time of the Protestant Rebellion, is still properly considered now. The music that moved people in the 1600s moves us today. The music that moves man universally today will move him universally 1,000 years from now. Great art is enduring. Proper art is enduring. What is truly art will endure, will sustain, will be recognized as such throughout time, not only by the so-called art critics who have developed a appreciation for the finer things, but by the common man. And that is what I mean by the sense of universal. There is a problem of aesthetics, which is primarily a philosophical one, but that is not my issue here. My issue here, now that I've defined the term, is to try to deal with the relationship between art and religion, its proper nature, and how a Christian should approach this issue. Before I proceed further, allow me to point out that art is not forbidden in use in Christianity. Now, I know some people, as I've sort of said before, the Calvinistic wing, tend to hold that the prohibition, which was given to Moses, and from Moses to the people of Israel, forbidding graven images, applies to all types of statues and sometimes to pictures. But I point out that this does not prohibit art in religious matters. First of all, if one reads the same books of the Old Testament, one will find out that God commanded that Moses have built on the Ark of the Covenant images of angels. These were graven images mandated by God. Also, the temple, when the temple was built and rebuilt, had decoration in it, which can only be described properly as artistic decoration. This artistic decoration was in the house of God. And as far as the performing arts goes, the Bible tells us that David danced in front of the Ark of the Covenant when it was brought into Jerusalem. What we are talking about here is that art is not forbidden, regardless of what a cursory reading of the Old Testament seems to indicate. Jesus was alive at the time of the temple and never denounced the temple whatsoever, despite that it had met a great deal of artistic decoration. Number two, we are not talking about pornography and trash. We are not talking about those things which masquerade as art. We are disregarding those. So we are not defending garbage. We are defending art, good art, art which communicates and achieves its goals. I would also point out that those who argue against art in religion seldom, if ever, argue against picture books for their children so that they can learn Bible stories. And although many people object to movies, they don't object to the more recent videotapes, which also show Bible stories. The point is this. The major difference between a picture and a statue is one more dimension. They are both representations of something which is not there. An artistic representation, if done correctly. By the same token, art, even real art, can be misused or abused. It can be used for a wrong purpose. It is an unfortunate fact of history that the Nazi regimes, the communist regimes, and other totalitarian regimes have used art in a sense of ritualistic behavior, in a sense of architecture, and in a sense of sculpture, painting, music, etc., to suppress their people, to prevent them from drawing their own conclusions, to prevent them from realizing the evil systems that they are serving. As a matter of fact, feminism today does this also in its chant, in its behavior, in its ritualistic dress and ritualistic aspects. And some of the more cultic, evil cultic aspects of Christianity do this. One can see this many times in fundamentalism, where hymns are sung very loudly. People have to stand up at certain times, raise their hands at certain times, even speak in tongues at certain times. This, in a certain sense, is a performing art which is used to suppress individual evaluations of what is being presented. I point out that in no case am I dealing with these issues. I'm dealing with true art presented in a true fashion. Art is primarily a form of communication, and if the message that it communicates is good, then art certainly brings about good. And anything which is good, by definition, cannot be bad. 2 points here. Number one, sin, which is what is wrong, is evil when we are dealing with Christianity, must be always a rejection of God. It must be a rejection of the message of Jesus and the acknowledgement of Jesus as Lord and Savior. If one is using art, one is not automatically rejecting Jesus. If one is not automatically rejecting Jesus, one is not sinning. By the same token, if the communication which the art attempts brings about a good result, then it is, in its primary, in its root meaning, a good thing. Let me give a simple example. If a person kneels in front of a crucifix, that is, the image of Jesus on the cross during the passion and death, this image may very well evoke in the person or communicate to the person the significance of sin, the evil of sin, and the high price that sin caused Jesus to pay. Now, if this gets across so that the person walks away resolved to sin less or to sin not at all, in other words, if it brings about a metanoia, a change of heart, a reform, then what has happened has been good and has not been a rejection of Jesus by any means. Therefore, if this were to occur, the only way that one could argue that this artistic expression is bad is that somehow that which brings a person closer to God is bad. But this is such a self-contradictory statement that no rational person could possibly sustain it or adhere to it or affirm it. Therefore, art may be used. It is allowable. We're talking again about the concept of communication. When we're talking about the concept of communicating basic Christian truths from one generation to another, from one person to another, when things are communicated, it is primarily a matter of style which determines how the communication is done. It is generally believed that Jesus spoke in Aramaic. Aramaic is a language not spoken by any of us any longer, and therefore some of the expressions he used had much more force, much more effect to his generation, to his time, in the idiom that he used. Therefore, sometimes a paraphrase rather than a direct translation will get the point across. The most effective preacher is the one who varies his message to his audience, or varies his message depending on the point he is trying to get across. Sometimes he will shock, sometimes he will persuade, sometimes he will demand, sometimes he will not answer questions which he raises. All of these things are nothing more than a matter of style with the goal of trying to make the communication of the message more effective. If art can make the communication of the message more effective, then it is a matter of style. And again, only generally those organizations such as feminism, Nazism, and cults try to suppress the individual style, forcing people into a certain lockstep sense of what they must say, how they must say it, and how their personalities must be suppressed. So therefore, again, art is allowed, but allow me to ask this question: can it be, or should it be, encouraged in Christianity? My argument is yes, it should be. Why? Because, number one, the message, the preaching of the gospel, is one of the primary goals of all Christian people, of all Christian religions, of all Christian denominations. It follows axiomatically from this that the more means that are used, the more aspects of human behavior that are employed, the more attributes of a human person that are appealed to, the more messages that the channel is sent through, the more effective the communication is likely to be. There is in us an artistic sense. There is in us a desire for pretty things, a desire to hear nice music, a desire to see pretty colors and nice cohesive artistic expressions. If this entire area is removed as a form of communication in Christianity, then what we have done is avoided one of the most effective means of communication. We have turned away from it, and no longer use this goal, this means, this method for the preaching of the gospel, for the transmission of the message of Jesus, and for the expansion of the kingdom of God. By staying away from that, one literally truncates his abilities, or if it's a denomination, that denomination limits its own sense, its own abilities, to transmit the Christian message. Again, since Christians are obligated to proclaim the message to everyone, everywhere, every time, it would follow that unless it is inherently evil, we also must do it every way possible. As I pointed out before, briefly, when I dealt with the potential objections, art is not inherently evil. Art is not forbidden by the laws of God. Art, again, was encouraged in Old Testament and New Testament times. So therefore, if we cut ourselves off from these things, what we are doing is quite literally rejecting means, and therefore art should not only be allowed, but should be encouraged. By the same token, artistic expression is a way that man may validly imitate God. Now, I do not say absurd the nature of God or the position of God. The reason why idols are wrong is because an idol represents a god which does not exist taking the place of true God, and to worship this idol is idolatry, or in some ways adultery, and therefore is wrong. For us to think that we can create the way God creates is certainly wrong. But God tells truth, we tell truth. God loves, we love. God can forgive, we should forgive. God may be merciful, we should be merciful. God is patient, we should be patient. All God is truthful, concerned, powerful, strong, protective. We should also be these things. In other words, since we are created in the image of God, we should try to do those things which God can do, which do not take his place or usurp his power, but instead reflect the divine nature of our creation. One of these aspects is quite literally artistic creation, in which we take something which previously exists, whether it be sound or clay or stone or paint, rearrange it in such a fashion by giving it a sense of our own spirit to carry a new message and create a new thing. It is an interesting point that one of the descriptions of the creation of man in the book of Genesis is that God takes dust or clay and breathes into it. In other words, what he has done, quite literally, is sculpt man out of a previously existing substance. And then he says that man is created in the image and likeness of God. Again, it appears that in this case, we should try to be like God and to create also artistically for purposes of getting the message across, for purposes of making life easier, for purposes of bringing joy to our fellow man. Because again, we are created for the purpose of being happy. Adam and Eve were happy in the Garden of Eden. And all that brings about joy and happiness and does not reject God is good. All that brings about happiness, which is not sin, is good. The basic issue of art versus non-art comes down to this basic position. Did God create man to be happy? Did God create man good? Did God create man with certain attributes by which man can give glory to God by imitating God? The Christian position must be yes to all of these. Obviously, it is clear from the book of Genesis that man was created by the loving, all-powerful, compassionate God to enjoy the Garden of Eden and ultimately heaven, both of which would bring happiness as long as man did not reject God. Therefore, man, if he still is good, even in the fallen nature, can still do good things. Now, it is an unfortunate situation among certain Protestant denominations that they emphasize the fall to the point that what they say is man is not crippled, not weakened, but destroyed. But to say that the creation of man is destroyed, the nature of man is destroyed by sin, is to say that sin is more powerful than God, that evil is more powerful than good. If we were to believe this, we would believe that we are on the losing side, because then ultimately Satan will triumph. Since we cannot, as Christians, hold this, we must believe that the winning side, good, is stronger than the losing side, evil. God's creation is more powerful than sin. All of us know that we may resist temptation if we choose to do so, and all of us know that we may do good acts when we choose to do so. All of us know that we do not need to sin. We know this in our personal experience, regardless of what our individual theologies say. Therefore, man is good, man is created to do good, man is capable of doing good, and man is created to be happy, to be joyful, to enjoy life. All of these attributes, all of these goals, all of these activities find reflection in artistic expression. And this is why I believe art should not only be allowed, it is not only not forbidden, but it should be encouraged in true Christianity. Now, I stated before that one of the goals of this series of tapes was to bring people closer to an understanding of what true Christianity is, with the concept and the hope that ultimately perhaps we would become that one faith with one baptism under one Lord. By this examination of art alone, one should be able to use this as a criteria to determine how close one's own individual belief system is to art, by means of art, to what true Christianity is. If one is in a system in which art is rejected as evil, then one has redefined sin. Again, sin must be rejection of God, not the use of something which is there. To put it slightly differently, sin must be what God prohibits us to do. If it is not prohibited, if it can bring about a good result, it is good. And that is art. Related tapes on this subject would be the tape on feeling, which is M8, M as in Mary 8, and tape H7, Statues and Saints. We would suggest you obtain these for further additional study. Those tapes or additional copies of this tape may be obtained by contacting us at ARM for All Roads Ministry, 55 Palen, that is spelled P as in Paul, A-L-E-N, Road, L as in Lincoln, 38. Our post office is Hope Well, that's one word, Junction, separate word, New York. The zip code is 12533. Your speaker has been Ben Lewis. Thank you for listening. We hope this tape has been of use and value to you. We hope it's made you think and brought you a little closer to the truth than you were before. If you have suggestions, comments, criticisms, etc., please feel free to contact me personally. Thank you and God bless.